Hey everyone, it's Steve Miller here in Washington. Great to have you with me on this Friday, June 24th for VOA's Asia Weekly Podcast. We're not going to waste any time this week and dive right into this week's main topic, and that is one country, two systems, which happens to be the idea, the concept, and the practice created by former Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping. Now, the idea was that there was simply one China, but that special, separate regions could also be set up and administered individually. Now, where do we see that today? Well, there's Taiwan, there's Macau, and of course, Hong Kong. But some people are currently saying that that system is in jeopardy. Back in December of 2015, five Hong Kong booksellers went missing. No one knew what exactly happened, not even the Hong Kong police. Then it was revealed that these five individuals were being held on the Chinese mainland for various crimes, some of which dated back more than a decade. The booksellers ultimately surfaced and confessed to these charges, and to date, four have been released. Only Guo Minhai remains in custody. Human Rights Watch China researcher Maya Wong told me in January of this year that there had been a campaign to restrict the flow of sensitive political books about China from Hong Kong, and that this appeared to be another step that Chinese authorities were taking to control freedom of expression in Hong Kong. So let's fast forward to last week. Lam Wong Ki, the fourth bookseller that was released on bail, returned to Hong Kong and asked authorities to drop their investigation and said that, well, he didn't need their help. He was supposed to go back to the Chinese mainland on June 16th, but instead, he held a press conference, spilling the beans on what happened and told everyone what went down. Lam told reporters that he said he was detained on October 24th of last year. He said that he had his ID and other documents taken by security officials, and he said that he was taken to a police station where officials refused to answer any of his questions. He was then transferred to Ningbo, where he claims he was forced to waive his rights to contact his family or even hire an attorney. In some recent interviews, Lam has also said that things were so rough that he contemplated suicide twice during his detention. Following Lam's press conference, Hong Kongers started to galvanize. Reuters says that over 4,000 people marched in Hong Kong on Saturday of last week to protest against China's detention of Lam and other booksellers, whose apparent crime seems to be publishing gossipy books about Chinese leaders, including President Xi Jinping, and then mailing those books to the Chinese mainland. Some protesters are even taking things a bit further and are calling for a return to British rule and ultimate independence. So, what are people saying? What's the mood in Hong Kong? And is there a price to be paid by China for these detentions? Hong Kong is a city that has a long history of protests. Back in 2014, thousands took to the street for nearly 2 months, trying to persuade the city and Beijing to grant universal suffrage. One of the leaders of that movement was Nathan Long. He currently also serves as the chair of the newly formed Democisto Party that plans on running two candidates in this year's Legislative Council elections, which really made me curious about how he viewed the Hong Kong government and its leadership now that he's trying to put members from his own party in it.
From the Occupy movement, you could easily see that the Hong Kong government is a puppet, that every major decision concerning Hong Kong's issue are actually made by the central government. It is quite obvious, and I think there was a consensus from the civic society that after the movement, it is really, really difficult to seek any concessions from the government, only by mild conversations or with the path of discussion with the government. And we have to resist, and we have to pressure the government, not only by talking with them, but with social movement.
Law says that the biggest lesson he learned from the pro-democracy protests was that collectively, as civic organizations, there needs to be greater organizational power in order to bring people together more effectively. In fact, he thinks that it's been a weakness spanning the last 10 or 20 years. That it's not just a matter of getting people out, but getting them involved in the process of social change, or as he puts it,
transform yourself from a participant to an organizer, and to be aware of social issues and to take actions to try to solve that social issue.
So, is it happening? Are people paying attention to what's going on, given that one allegation is that bookseller Li Bo was taken from Hong Kong by Chinese authorities?
I believe that actually the whole society is keeping an eye on this issue, and I believe that in the future, there will be more actions concerning this issue.
But what does he feel is the most pressing issue to be addressed?
Well, I think the cross-border adoption is a more serious perspective to look on this issue, because originally, we think that the personal safety of Hong Kong people is guaranteed by one country, two system. But in Hong Kong, we have never imagined such thing will happen.
Law says that the apparent abduction and detention shows
really solid proof of the malfunction and breach of one country, two systems.
And that's really the crux of the issue. Beijing created one country, two systems, and it effectively sets the rules. So where does that leave things for this former student leader turned political party chair?
Well, I believe that it is really difficult to change the system and to against the Communist Party. But I believe that we have to still organize social movement and civic movement in order to create pressure to defend what we have on hand. And I still believe in organizing people to fight against the Communist Party work. So that's what we're doing.
So that's one perspective from Hong Kong, one of a former student turned party chair who, after demonstrating in the streets, seeks to change the system from within. But what about those who are already in the legislature, that are part of the Hong Kong government itself? Well, I reached out to Hong Kong's chief executive, CY Long, but his office informed me that his schedule was simply too busy to appear on the podcast. I also reached out to Hong Kong's chief secretary for administration, Carrie Lam, the person who happens to hold the number two position in Hong Kong's government. However, her office responded that she was out on leave and would be unavailable. I also tried to reach New People Party lawmaker Regina Ip, but got no response. And out of all the legislators I contacted, only one agreed to appear on the podcast. And that was Emily Lau, the chair of Hong Kong's Democratic Party. I kicked off our conversation by reminding her, the last time we spoke, we talked about one country, two systems, and you gave this great analogy about how it was designed to be essentially a firewall between mainland China and Hong Kong. But you also said that if the allegations were true that Li Bo was taking from Hong Kong, it was essentially like driving a truck through it and it could come down. Based on what we have learned this week by Mr. Lam's statements, where do you think things stand right now with one country, two systems?
Well, I think one country, two systems is at great risk. So it is, it's very important that the central government in Beijing must know that people are very, very scared. And they must come out to assure the Hong Kong people that such thing cannot happen again. And of course, they should confess and they should apologize for doing so and punish the culprit and to ensure us that this will not happen again. You may say that they won't do that, and maybe you're right, but we have to insist. And as you heard yesterday, the chief executive, CY Leung, said that he will write a letter to Beijing. Obviously, that's woefully inadequate. And so we have to push the Hong Kong government to do more, to convey our concerns and our fears to the central government.
Well, what do you think would be an appropriate response by the chief executive?
Well, he should go up to Beijing. And we've said that for months, ever since the story broke, because this is a very important matter, and it is really the duty of the chief executive of Hong Kong to convey the people's concerns and suggestions to the central government so as to let Beijing know that the government here, the legislative councillors and the public regard this as a very, very serious matter.
Well, speaking of the public, what are your constituents really saying to you? Has their trust in the system been eroded by this latest incident?
I think so. I think people are very concerned, and some are saying that they will leave Hong Kong. And those who want to go, if they are free, I mean, if they can afford it, I'm sure they will go and find a better future. But there are many who do not want to go or who cannot go, and they will have to stay in Hong Kong. So it is up to all of us to work hard to make sure that one country, two systems will not be in complete tatters. And of course, the success of one country, two systems is very much dependent on Beijing's willingness to exercise self-restraint. And that is something that we have to keep calling on Beijing to do.
So what exactly are their concerns? Is it that there could be more cross-border renditions?
Yes. Well, I think that is very obvious that they are afraid that Beijing may send people to Hong Kong to abduct Hong Kong people. So it could be Mr. Lee, Mr. Lam, Mrs. Wong, Mr. Chan, and so on. And so people are very frightened. And as I told you last time, people in Hong Kong are afraid of mainland rule, communist rule. And Deng Xiaoping promised us that it will not happen because it will be Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong under one country, two systems.
But let's be honest here. The current agreement with Beijing evaporates in 2047. So are people looking at things from a more short-term perspective, or are they looking down the road long-term?
Well, I think that people are very, very worried about their future, both long-term and short-term. And so some are making plans, some are leaving, and especially if they have kids. And but there are those who are determined to fight. And I think that that number may increase because the more pressure you apply, then the people's desire to rise up and rebel may be stronger. And of course, there is this big march coming up on the 1st of July. And this is an annual ritual. And I hope many people will turn out and to demonstrate their concerns. But of course, I hope that it will be done in a peaceful and orderly way.
We do see the election for the next chief executive next year. Could it influence the way people view the election?
Yeah, well, we certainly hope that CY Leung will not be allowed or will not stand for election because he should know that people do not support him. And I just don't know who else that will come up that really can defend the Hong Kong people's interests, but also will be acceptable to Beijing. I mean, we are really caught in this terrible situation.
Do you see any way out of it?
Well, I think the real way out, of course, is democracy under one country, two systems. So Beijing has to realize that Hong Kong people, the majority, are not asking for independence. We support one country, two systems, but Beijing has to trust the people and allow them to elect their local government.
Emily Lau is the chair of the Democratic Party in Hong Kong, joining me by phone. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you.
But what is the larger picture here? How could these events affect China on a global scale? For that insight, I dialed up Thomas Vien, East Asia analyst with Stratfor, a Texas-based think tank. I started by asking him if there was a price China would have to pay for these latest detentions.
I think there's certainly a price, and I think that China actually knows this. If you look at the way that China actually prefers to bring people back, it tends to be that when they're trying to chase down fugitives abroad, they make sure to emphasize that when they go after these people, it's overt, they're promoting rule of law. Anytime that they work with local law enforcement, they'll be sure to highlight that. And they like to include a picture of uniformed Chinese police officers marching these people onto planes, marching them off of planes.
But in this case, it really wasn't overt. I mean, all these people were detained on the mainland, with the exception of Li Bo. They were held pretty much in seclusion. They weren't talking to Hong Kong police. And then all of a sudden, they appeared on state television confessing their so-called crimes. I mean, right. Is that the standard operating procedure we see with other people? I mean, if you see the graft challenges that Xi Jinping made, is there a difference in the way they're handling these two?
Oh, absolutely. I think that what's interesting is that they were covert in the way that they got them, but then they put them on state TV. So it's something where they can't, they realize that they have no way of legally getting them, but they still need to get them, just send a message to them. And because these people have intelligence that they believe is important. And we notice that even after they've been outed as basically grabbing these people abroad, they haven't really changed their methods for the rest of the anti-graft investigations. There's obvious preference for the overt that remains even after this is known.
So what's the price that China has to pay then?
I think that the prices are basically long-term. There is long-term interest for China in promoting this image that it's a law-abiding country, promotes rule of law, that's really been hurt by this. There's a long-run interest in really administering Hong Kong under one country, two systems, and keeping it stable. That's really been hurt by this. And then there's a long-term interest in selling the formula of Hong Kong and one country, two systems to Taiwan, and basically saying, look, you just come back to the mainland, we'll manage your foreign affairs, and you're free to manage your domestic policy. And I think that insofar as that might have held a little bit of appeal at one point, I think that's basically gone at this moment.
Well, I guess my question for you is this. In your opinion, if you take a look at what's being alleged to have happened in Hong Kong, if you look at the Wukong village, is one country, two systems broken?
I think it's how we define, one country, two systems as far as China's purposes. For the sake of Hong Kong's stability, I think that there's always been this sense from Hong Kongers that China's kind of slicing away one country, two systems in small pieces. And I think that they're upset, but there's a limit to what Hong Kong can really do to resist China, just given that, they don't really have their own serious military forces. On the other hand, Taiwan does have some capacity to resist and does look upon this and say, ooh, we haven't signed on to this deal yet. Maybe we want to reconsider as a voting population whether this is actually a good idea. So I think that in the sense of Taiwan, it could basically have damaged it pretty far, because this was a debate at one point, and I don't know that it is anymore as something viable for Taiwan.
Now, speaking of Taiwan, former President Ma was supposed to go to Hong Kong on a recent book trip to speak at a book event. And the current administration in Taiwan denied his travel permit, citing unknown security concerns. Is that playing into this at all?
Well, I read this. I really read this as just being part of the general noise of Taiwanese politics, and this is just part of their partisan politics. There, they have an outgoing president, and then you want to be sure to control him very tightly. But I do think that if we look at a broader level, it highlights a key anxiety that a lot of Taiwanese have, because Ma's presidency was really known for its work in promoting greater cross-strait integration. He was planning to really bring this up as a highlight of his presidency when he went to Hong Kong and say a lot of things about the 1992 consensus that the then ruling KMT signed in 1992 with the mainland, basically where they agreed that both Taiwan and the mainland were part of one China and they would interpret it differently. The ruling DPP has not wanted to endorse this principle. And I think that when the Taiwanese look at Hong Kong today, they're more and more saying, well, it's not looking like such a great thing, this 1992 consensus. Giving it lip service helps maintain some stability, but I think that when they see Hong Kong, again, they have tremendous anxiety on whether greater cross-strait integration is really in their best interest.
And one last question before I let you go. Is China taking a gamble if they continue these kinds of activities down the road?
I think that it would be a gamble, and I think that They recognize it. They prefer not to do it. But the calculus right here is that when we see them grabbing these booksellers in Thailand, Hong Kong, and the mainland. They are doing it because they feel that the consequences of not getting these people are greater than if you get these people. And these consequences are probably going to be borne by a very, very small part of the top leadership. This whole incident appears like it's related to power struggles going on in Beijing. Some of Lam Wing-Key's revelations are that he was being interrogated by a central investigation group that is, these things are stood up to target high-level Communist Party officials. So what I really read this as is they do it because there's a political power struggle where a small group within the leadership thinks that its short-term survival is jeopardized if it doesn't do these kidnappings. And they are willing to value this short-term survival over a lot of these long-term interests. So that's why we see these kind of gambles being made. That's why we see the long-term sacrifices of the rule of law campaign and one country, two systems.
All right. Thomas Vian is an East Asia analyst over at Stratfor. Hey, thank you so much for your time this week.
Yeah, of course. Thank you very much for having me.
So for now, it remains to be seen how things will play out in Hong Kong and if a political power struggle will develop, as Thomas Vian believes. And that's going to do it for me this week. But you know what? The conversation doesn't end here. So please hit me up on Facebook or Twitter at Steve Miller VOA and let me know your thoughts and opinions. And also be sure to join us on our community Facebook page, VOA Now. Now, to get every new podcast delivered to you automatically, be sure to subscribe. It's quick, it's easy, and of course, free to do. You can subscribe in iTunes or on our website, voanews.com. Well, thank you so much for joining me this week. In Washington, I'm Steve Miller. And until next time, be true to yourself and always be awesome.